Psych Podcast, a podcast where I discuss with my friend and colleague, Paul Bloom, everything intro psych. We said last week that we got to the point where we're talking about what you're an expert in, but even more so this time, we're talking about what you do.
So I'll begin with a confession, which is for somebody who spent so much of his life studying language, I actually have no gift for learning second languages. We were talking about this before. I was raised in Quebec, mostly French-speaking province, and my French is terrible. I grew up in kind of a Jewish-Greek neighborhood where my friends didn't speak French. But then I went to school and a lot of huge emphasis on learning French. And then it's French. Montreal is, you know, 50-50, a French city. And I just can't learn. I went to Israel. Couldn't learn Hebrew. I've traveled all around the world, each time barely being able to eke out a thank you. Where's the bathroom? So maybe this situates me, because I'm interested in language development, situates me to appreciate how difficult language learning can be. And my original love, the part of psychology I was originally into, was on the interface between development and language. When I was at MIT in graduate school, I took courses with Noam Chomsky. I took linguistics classes for much of my career, and I've moved away from language. A lot of my research now is on stuff which actually you and I have done together, questions involving morality and notions of self and pleasure. I don't do primary language research anymore, but it was really the first part of my career, you know, my first love.
And when I first met you, your lab was still very much filled with graduate students who were working on language. And your first book was How Children Learn the Meaning of Words.
Right. My first book was flat out language development, flat out the study of language. And I think, and we could talk about why, that even if you don't study language as a psychologist, even if that's not your main focus, there's so much interesting here. And there's so much that ties into every other aspect of the mind.
And might be worth saying that there is a connection between linguistics and psychology. Oftentimes, there are disciplines lumped together under the umbrella term cognitive science. And psychology and linguistics and computer science and philosophy are the disciplines that are under this umbrella. But linguistics and psychology, they've had a relationship with each other, I think, from the earliest days of speculative psychology, right?
That's right. They've often teamed up to ask questions like, how do children learn language? How do we process language? How do we understand language? How does language instantiate it in the brain? Particularly looking at questions like bilinguals, you know, how do you keep your languages apart if you know two or three or four or five? A lot of psychologists and linguists have been interested in the question of how does language influence the way you think? And I think everybody has some familiarity to debate where people say, oh my gosh, people who learn English and people who learn Navajo or Mandarin Chinese will think in different ways because of it. And a lot of people have been very interested in those questions.
It is one of those questions that seems so compelling and for which you can design some very clever experiments to try to figure out exactly how much the language that you speak matters.
And that thing, that brings me to a theme that cuts across my whole book, which is there's a lot of stuff which is going to be specific to the domains we're talking about. But a theme that cuts across my whole book is I agree that there's some things we just can't know. We just maybe just beyond us. It's not the kind of thing you could study. It's maybe not the sort of thing anybody could ever study. It's a philosophical or abstract question. But I think almost every interesting question is not like that. And so a question like, does the language you learn affect how you think? There's a million ways to test it, to take this wonderfully exciting and interesting question, and you could put it to the test. And people have done exactly that. In all sorts of ways, and a lot of controversy. But I think we've learned a lot about the ways language influences thought. And I think in particular, ways in which language doesn't influence thought.
Let's start maybe at the beginning. There are often claims that so-and-so, some psychological faculty, is unique to humans. So people will say, man is the only animal that laughs, or man is the only animal that cries, or human beings are the only ones who have disgust. Oftentimes when you dig into these claims, It turns out that they're wrong in some deep way, that while other non-human animals might not have the exact same kind of say, emotional response that humans have, you can very clearly see that it's a matter of degree. Language, though, might be the one thing that people are right about when they say that.
Yeah, and from an evolutionary point of view, we should really be willing to expect that some capacities exist to some degree in some animals, exist to a greater or lesser degree in other animals. But evolutionary theory is also fully consistent with the idea that you could have something in one animal, which doesn't exist in another animal. Bats have echolocation. We don't have echolocation. Steve Pinker, in his wonderful book, The Language Instinct, which was a book I took a lot of inspiration on when writing this chapter, talks about elephants' trunk. And elephants have trunks. Virtually no other animal has a trunk. Sometimes evolution takes a certain path and creates an honest-to-God new capacity within a species that other species don't have. So there's nothing sort of anti-Darwinian or weird to say humans are the only creature to have language. It's kind of, like I was saying before, an empirical question.
It's one of the questions that I find students come to with the most excitement, because we've all been exposed to some examples of animals that seem to have something like language. And so for me, it was Coco, the ape that could do sign language. And so I think I came in fully expecting that, well, language was a matter of degree. After all, Coco seems to be communicating. It's a good opportunity, I think, to talk about what language is and what language isn't. So would you say Coco was not using language?
I would say that people are free to use the term language in all sorts of ways. Some people like to use the word language just to mean communicating. In that case, Coco definitely was using language and was using language before Coco learned anything from people. Bird song is language, and bee dances are language, and traffic signs are language. Music can be language. Sometimes people take terms for language and extend them to other domains. So the linguist David Crystal points out he owns a book called The Grammar of Cooking and another book called The Syntax of Sex.
Way to add some spice into your sex life. Call it syntax.
That's right. And you know, I'm not the cops. If you want to use language that way, that's totally fine. But there's sort of a more scientific question we could ask, which is, let's look at the things that sort of prototypical, what linguists call natural languages, like the sort that people use all the time to communicate with one another that emerge in every society, like English and Dutch, Navajo, Choctaw, Korean, Hindi, and on for, say, 6,000 more. So we could study those and say, well, what do they have in common? What do we know about them? And let's call these natural languages for a second. Well, we know they have phonology, which is the basic units of sound for spoken languages, and the basic units of movement for sign languages. We know they have morphology, which is they have words, as well as structures to put together smaller words into bigger words. So you could have dog and house, you could have dog house. You could have walk and ing, you have walking. And then they got syntax, which is systems that put together words and phrases into larger phrases and sentences. So, and there's other things besides, but that's a good start. And now we say, okay, that's what languages have. And you say, well, do birds have these? Does Coco have these? Do traffic lights have these? Does DNA have language in this sense? And there's been a lot of argument about this, a lot of debate. And some people say, well, there's a little bit of something analogous to syntax in, say, birdsong. There's something maybe analogous to pragmatics in how dogs communicate. But I think for the most part, the answer is no. And this is meant to be no disrespect towards other creatures. It's just we have our own communication system. There's a lot going on in birdsong that we don't have. There's a lot going on in bee dance that we don't have. But our communication system, and for what's going on, we'll call it language, turns out to be the sort of thing that doesn't show up in other creatures.
So, as you say, nobody is saying that Coco isn't communicating and understanding, nor is my dog failing to communicate and understand when I say sit. Clearly, there is a particular sound that he is responding to that has some meaning, and in the deep sense of meaning. It's just not the same as language, human language, in these important ways.
That's right. That's right. So you have to pull apart language from communication. And one basic fact, I think, is that the scope of things which count as communication is much broader than language in the sense we're talking about. You could communicate perfectly well, you know, you get somebody cuts you off on the road and you glare at the driver. You've communicated something. And you don't have to share a common language to appreciate it. You just communicate something.
I like that glaring was the example, but yes.
we are trying to keep this discussion as PG and possibly G as possible. So glaring, the ultimate sign of disrespect. You know, a mother could teach her daughter how to swing a tennis racket. And the mother's communicating this idea to the daughter by putting the racket in her hand and swinging it. They're doing it in silence. But plainly, there's communication going on. And there's some language that, although I think it's really reasonable to think language evolved for communication, there's some language that isn't communication. Like you'd be thinking about things for yourself. You could be ruminating in your head. You can be playing word games. You could be enjoying the music of language. People use language in all sorts of ways, particularly in a literate society, which don't involve communicating information from one person to another.
In discussing this sort of features of a language, morphology, phonology, syntax, you, I think, say explicitly in your book, these features allow humans to do something that no other animal does seem to be able to do. It's a kind of communication that is boundless. It's limitless. The number of things that we can say, given some basic rules and some basic vocabulary, seems to be effectively infinite, although it's not, but effectively, it seems like it's kind of like achievement unlocked the minute we develop this ability.
It's astonishing. And there's a couple of things to be said about it. One is that you would only get, and this is something the philosopher Jerry Fodor points out, this would only matter given that we are the kind of creatures that could also think a potentially limitless amount of thoughts. So if all you could, you know, if all you could think is, you know, food, sex, rest, and those are your three thoughts, having a limitless syntactic a generator machine stuck to your head, you still say the three thoughts. So the fact that we can generate a potentially limitless amount of thoughts and understand the potentially limitless amount of thoughts, potentially we always stick in here because life's finite. So in practice, we're going to run out of time. We're going to die before a certain thought is said. But the fact that we can do that rests on this incredibly powerful mental system we have, and then it's plugged into this incredibly powerful linguistic system. And that gives us that something which no creature, natural or even artificial at this point, can do, which is you could think a thought nobody has ever heard thought before. And say it to me, and now I will understand it. Here, I'll say a sentence nobody on earth has ever said before, I bet, which is the television show The Crown just came out, and my wife and I are going to watch the first episode tonight. Often, you know, we'll have to watch the first episode. If it's not too late, we'll watch a second, and sometimes even a third. It's a fairly complicated sentence. A two-year-old wouldn't be able to understand it. I don't know how many words it took, 20, 25, 30. I bet no one's ever said it. And you immediately understood it in literally a fraction of a second.
And the meaning of that sentence isn't something I had stored in memory, importantly.
That's right. And the only way to make sense of what's going on is we have in our heads a cluster of words, a lexicon with associated meanings. We have the capacity to put together these words to make meaningful propositions, a syntax. And then we have the ability to say them. We have the principles of phonology to turn them into sounds, or if we were sign language users, to turn them into motions. And that's amazing. It is an extraordinary feat.
It is a bit mind-blowing when you think about all of the words that have been put together and printed, let alone uttered. It's hard to imagine the sheer quantity of meaningful things. Meaningful here, being very broad.
Yes.
Not important, necessarily.
Not important, but, you know, I just finished reading the novel Lessons by Ian McEwan. And actually, I say reading, I listened to it as an audiobook, which took, I think, like 16 hours of talking, of putting together this rich, structured narrative that took so many hours to even say, and got it all into my head. So now I have in my head characters and scenes and ideas and statements and speeches, some which will last till the end of my days. And, you know, you don't see monkeys doing this. You don't see birds doing this.
Is it true that there was once a king who tried to raise children in isolation to see what language they would speak naturally?
Yes, I don't tell the story in my chapter, so you're catching me a bit off guard. But so I'm going to forget the name of the king. But the king did an experiment, according to Herodotus, who tells these wonderful stories that are not entirely true because often they involve magic and superpowers. But the king forbade anybody to have a kid being raised, and when the kid was raised, but nobody was allowed to speak to the kid. And then the question is, what would the kid's first words be, and in what language would they be? This is kind of a settle the bet thing you do when you're a king dealing with other people. And if I have it right, the kid's first word was bekos, used to refer to bread, which is bread in language Phrygian. so there's your answer. It wasn't Cockney, it wasn't Dutch, it wasn't Arabic, it was Phrygian. And some psychologists, that's a bizarre experiment. If it was real, it would tell us something about language being part of us. But there is this extraordinary research program led by the psychologist Susan Golden Meadow. And in fact, one of their papers is called Beyond Herodotus, which looks at children who have no language. These are children who have no language, not because of some sort of brain damage, but because they're deaf, raised by families who speak and don't sign to them, and they don't learn sign language. And what you might imagine under any sort of plausible learning theory is that they'd remain languageless. They don't get language, nothing in, nothing out. But instead, these kids, if there's more than one of them, there's a community of kids together, will create language out of nothing. They will start creating signs. They will use a rudimentary phonology, a rudimentary morphology, and a rudimentary syntax. They will create their own language.
That's incredible.
This was a great case study. And there's a second case study. This is Annie Sengus and others looking at the creation of Nicaraguan sign language. And it's a separate case where communities of children deprived of the proper linguistic input would create their own languages. And this is part of the sort of origin of some sign languages. They're created by children.
You speak in your chapter a bit about this debate between people who believe in innate capabilities and people who believe that everything is learned, and how language has, you know, the study of language has played a role in this. Plainly, this is evidence that there is something innate that is causing us to produce language and to understand language. But of course, it can't all be, right? You even said in what you just told me, you need at least one other kid, and they will create a language of their own. But in the absence of anybody to talk to, it's not as if we spontaneously speak Mandarin because it was innate.
That's right. There's, I think, a huge and actually very productive debate between over the extent to which language is hardwired and built in and part of our genetic endowment, versus how much is picked up. It's created by cultures and picked up through the sort of same learning mechanisms you would learn the plot of a movie, or, you know, how to read a book or something cultural. And on the one hand, nobody thinks it's entirely innate. For instance, when you learn English, you have to learn the word for dogs is dog. Well, that's a historical accident. You just have to learn that. You might bring to the task of learning it some really complicated cognitive mechanisms, but that has to be learned. The fact that we construct sentences in English like dogs chase cats, that also has to be learned, because not every other language works that way, and so on and so on and so on. So some stuff has to be learned. On the other hand, I think there's a good case to be made that some of the fundamentals of language, such as the idea that languages have these kind of rich syntactic structures, maybe specific rules for how to organize words and phrases. Certainly the set of phonemes you're supposed to start off with to use a language. Certainly, not certainly, but perhaps natural word meanings are all part of the sort of initial equipment that a child brings to this. And this is why a child can learn language, and a monkey who lacks these initial capacities cannot.
You might think if you were an alien landing on Earth and you just were plopped down in the middle of any well-populated city, that the ability to write and to read is innate. Because if I were left to my own devices and I knew nothing and I started collecting data, I would find that most everybody reads and writes. And I would find this startlingly structured way in which everybody wrote the same things. And even if I looked across other cities in the world, I would say, well, their symbols are a little different, but they seem to have right around, you know, 20 something letters. And you might think that the written word is might be a product of innate capabilities, but it in fact is exactly not. Like, it is very much not. That had to be spread by culture. There was a moment in history when somebody devised an alphabet, and it was such a sticky idea that everybody started using the alphabet in some form or another. Language didn't need to be marketed.
That's right. So they're a nice sort of pair to pit against each other, which is spoken language or sign language versus written language. Written language is an invention. It might have been invented in different ways at different times. There's many ways. There's ideographs and there's alphabets in the standard sense. And these get created. And they're sticky. They're really good for societies. But it's very, very difficult to learn to read and write. You'd think it'd be very easy since you already know the base language. It's just a transcription system, just a translation system. But it is extremely difficult. Many people are not capable of doing it. Their minds are not properly configured. We call these disorders like dyslexia. And they really struggle with it. And to continue with the sort of Susan Golden Meadow Herodotus story, if you put a bunch of kids together on an island and they all had paper and pencil, they're not going to create a written language.
Right.
That's just not something which is spontaneous. That is something which is a cultural invention that came with difficulty.
Right. In fact, we have many hundreds of thousands of years in which were exactly that.
That's right. And we see here, by the way, the question from this point of view, what's a language in the sense of both being complicated and kind of hardwired, isn't a sort of a priori one. We're not sitting on our high chairs, our armchairs, philosophically speculating, that's a language versus that's a language. And instead, you look carefully. So you look carefully at birdsong, and it doesn't look at all like a human language. You look at the monkey cries. You look at Coco's communication. It is very, very different from how a child speaks. Now you look at people who are deaf constructing a sign language. Well, you know, it may have turned out that we call that a language, but we were mistaken to call it a language. American Sign Language isn't a language. It's just something else. It's a form of gesture or something. But linguists have looked at this very closely, and it turns out that structurally, these sign languages contain the same trinity of phonology, morphology, and syntax as spoken languages. And then when you look at it developmentally, they develop in almost precisely the same way.
So right around age one, a deaf child, if exposed to signing, might start babbling.
Exactly. Exactly. Laura Ann Petito found exactly that the timing is just about identical for the emergence of babbling, emergence of first words, emergence of sentences. It gets complicated because the syntax of ASL is actually closer to that of a language like Hebrew than that of a language like English. So Hebrew would be a better comparison case for different milestones. But it seems as if whatever we possess, capacity for language we possess, it's not specifically calibrated for speech. It's more general, sort of amodal. If you don't have auditory information, it'll come out in your hands.
It's always trying to emerge.
Yes, yes. It didn't have to be. You know, a Skinnerian view on this sees language as kind of, you know, persuaded, rewarded, eked out of the kid. You know, you're punished for not doing it. You're rewarded for doing it right. Over to end, it calibrates and so on. And But you look at language development, and language development is far from instantaneous. It takes a long time. For one thing, you know, you have to learn tens of thousands of words. And that just takes a long, long time. There's just so many hours in the day. But the emergence of it doesn't seem to require reinforcement and punishment in any real sense. There are societies where people don't talk to their kids. And even in these societies, kids learn to talk. Some kids end up talking late. And then when they talk late, the language comes out as if they've been learning it the whole time from other people. There's a story about Einstein, which I will repeat, even though it's almost certainly not true. But it's a very nice story. Einstein was a late talker, the story goes. And once he's with his family, and he sips the soup, and he says, "The soup is too hot." And they're startled. And they said, "My God, you've never spoken before." And he says, "Well, up to now, everything's been fine." Okay, that's not a true story.
Can we talk a little bit about the trajectory of language learning in the lifespan? So we mentioned earlier that right around one, children are starting to use words. At around age two, maybe one and a half, they're starting to put those words together, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And one qualification here is that language acquisition has been a nice field to study because it's been so cross-cultural and cross-linguistic. And there's some very interesting differences between how a language like English and a language like Hebrew or Latin or various forms of Chinese are learned. So English is a language which kind of works. There's technical terms for this, but basically it has some fairly distinct words. And then you just put together the words into sentences. There's a lot of syntax, not as much morphology. It's not as much word stuff. So In English, you have the word dog, and then you add an S, and then it's dogs. And that's English morphology. But you know, a language like German, it gets much more complicated. You have very long German words that convey all sorts of ideas. And then you get to certain other languages, and these languages are, to some extent, almost all words, just long words, and some lesser degree of syntax. But answering your question, zooming in on English, it's exactly right. You start off babbling, and you know, people say that babbling, you get the system attuned. You get first words, typically things like mama, papa, milk, water, car. My older son's first word was a gitta, meaning kitty. Whenever the cat ran by, he said gitta. And then and you get words like that. And then they put them together and you get what used to be called a very, very archaic term, telegraphic speech. Because there used to be such things as telegraphs where people would send information, but it was expensive to send it by the word. So you wouldn't say, "Oh my gosh, my money was stolen while I was in Paris. Could you please send me some money?" Because that would cost too much. You have to say, "Money stolen, send help," or something like that. And kids talk that way. Younger kids talk that way. They wouldn't say, "I'd like a glass of milk, mother." They'd say, "Want milk. Nice cookie," you know, they talk like that. Then the words come in, and then you have the flourishing of syntax, about a year and a half, 2 years. And then all sorts, it just gets better and better. Vocabulary growth accelerates, particularly once kids start to read, until by the time kids are about 17, they know about 60 to 80,000 words, if they're learning English. And then the sort of to end it off is the bad news, which is there appears to be a critical period for language learning, which is it's much easier to learn a language when you're young than when you're older. If you learn past puberty, most likely you'll retain an accent in that language. And there's some debate. Typically, people who learn language later just don't learn it as well, even if they learn it for many, many, many years.
Paul, the examples even that you gave of the first words that a baby learns, dog, cat, mom, dad, house, car, motorcycle is one of your examples, banana. These are all nouns. Why? Well, first of all, is it the case that this is just true across all languages, that those are the first words that children learn? And second, why? Why do verbs and adjectives take longer?
It's a really good question. So first answer is yes, nouns are overrepresented in children's early vocabularies. They often contain some other words. There may be words for actions like kiss, or a word like up, an imperative, pick me up, or sometimes the word no.
Yeah.
Those could also show up early. But nouns are overrepresented early on. And there are two stories about this, which could both be right, but put in different ways. One story is it has to do with language, which is that nouns don't require any further structure to know that they're nouns. So if I point to something and say glorp, you could say, well, glorp's a name for the thing. But if I want to describe that something somebody's doing, I typically need to sort of use a sentence. Like I have to say, you know, the cat is glorping the dog. For adjectives, you typically have to have a noun. So it's the glorp dog. Certainly for prepositions and determiners and other very small parts of speech, they only make sense in the context of language. But somehow nouns are sort of bare. You don't need syntax to get them. So that's one reason why they may be privileged in development. A reason I'm a little bit more sympathetic is that it's not so much nouns as a language structure are immediate to us. It's that we're really caught up in with objects. So it's just natural when, to use a classic example, a rabbit's bouncing by and somebody says, in a foreign language, says, Gavagai. You're looking at the scene. You know the rabbit is bouncing. You know the rabbit is white. You know the rabbit is above the ground. You know how fast it's moving. You know all of that. But what leaps out at you is the rabbit.
Right.
That there's a single object out there. And I've actually done some studies on this, looking at the dominance object that objects have relative to other things like parts. So you see somebody and they have two hands and two feet. And it is perfectly plausible to see them to think about the hands or the feet. But we don't tend to do that. Our first guess is it's the whole object, the whole thing. And so this is why for every child, some word for person is learned before hand. For every child on earth, the word cup is learned before handle. The word dog is learned before tail. Because the natural interpretation is person, cup, dog. And this actually speaks to the issue of language and thought. Because when I'm talking here, am I talking about language? I don't think so. I'm actually just talking about thought. That if they were to strip your language away from you, you would still think about dogs before you thought about tails, cups before you thought about handles, and so on.
That makes sense, because what you were saying before about the sort of bare form of a word being a noun just kind of pushes the question back. That is, why do the bare forms of our words, why are those nouns? You need a further explanation, and that might be just because whole object things are the ones that just dominate in our perception and our thought from early on.
Yeah. And that's, you know, we'll be talking about the relationship between language and thought. But you're pointing out something which I didn't really describe in my book, which is language has all sorts of structures and intricacies. What's a bare form? What needs other words to make sense? And to some extent, this is going to be parasitic on how we think. Like, it's probably not a quirk of language that you could say the word dogs in absence and you kind of make sense of it. But you can't say the word the or in or of in absence. It doesn't make any sense. It's because the concepts that the, in, of capture, these abstract semantic concepts, are concepts that the way we think about the world are such that they require other things to give them some sort of heft. You can imagine us evolving differently. So there's all these science fiction conceptions of people, of aliens, which have different languages because they think about the world differently. The philosopher Willard Quine, who thought up the Gavagai example, points out, you know, if our brains were constituted differently, we wouldn't think about rabbits at all. We might just think of actions of rabbiting, where rabbits happen. The philosopher Nelson Goodman says, you know, right now we see a color green and we think it's green. But he said, well, what if we had the concept grew, which is green until a year 3000, then purple? Well, it's a ridiculous concept. Who in the world would have that kind of concept? That's not what green would ever mean. But that has to do with how our brains are wired up. We're wired up to see colors as enduring things. We're wired up to see objects rather than things that instantiate actions.
You know, when I started studying, I worked a bit with the developmental psychologist Letitia Nagels, who studied verbs and verb acquisition. And of course, she was victim of this noun bias. So most of the time when developmental psychologists say they're studying the beginnings of language, they're talking about nouns. Very rarely are they talking about the development of verbs.
Yeah, Letitia Nagels worked with the late Lila Gleitman, who was one of the great leaders of the field. And together, along with some other scholars, they developed the idea of syntactic bootstrapping. It's a very clever idea, and it makes a sort of intuitive sense. So you can kind of see how we could use our sight and our sound and our intelligence to figure out what dog means. Someone points to a dog, says dog. We look at the dog. We see that's what they're looking at. They're using the word dog. They regularly use the word dog for dog. Oh, I guess that's a dog. Yeah. But how do you learn a verb like thinking?
Right.
You know, how do you learn the difference between give and receiving? Since any act of giving is an act of receiving and vice versa. And it's a huge puzzle. And the way they solved the puzzle was they said, first you learn the nouns through the way we're talking, but it's a wider, this is part of the answer to your question earlier. And then they're smart enough to use the syntax of language to infer the meanings of verbs. So if you heard the sentence, suppose you now know what the nouns mean. You hear, the man glorped the woman a cookie. Well, from the syntax, you could say, well, plainly, it's a verb could mean a transfer of possession. It could mean something like gave or transferred or threw to or something like that. If you heard a sentence like the man glorped the glass, it could have a meaning like broke or saw or poked. And if you heard something like John glorped that 2 + 2 = 4, the syntax tells you something incredible, which is it's a person doing something to an idea, a proposition. Well, what do you do to an idea? Well, you could think about it, or you could say it, or you could doubt it, or lie about it, or dream about it.
Understand it.
Or understand it. And so once you know the syntax of your language, and once you picked up a few nouns, you could use this amazing trick to learn the meanings of fairly abstract terms. And I think syntactic bootstrapping is one of the best ideas in psychology.
That's very cool. This episode of Psych is once again sponsored by GiveWell.org. GiveWell is that organization that is dedicated to helping you find charities that have the biggest impact, that is, that give you the biggest bang for your buck. This information can actually be really hard to come by because most charities just won't tell you how your money will be used, how much good it will accomplish. You know that you're helping a cause, but you have no idea how much. So GiveWell sought out to address this problem. And the way that they did it is they have a staff of 25 researchers. They have researchers with backgrounds in economics, biology, and philosophy. And these researchers spend over 40,000 hours each year just looking for giving opportunities that will maximize donors' impact. They dig into a charity's specific data, their work, their implementation of their programs. They model the cost-effectiveness of the charities to estimate which charities have the biggest impact. And most importantly, I think this will give you a good sense of the organization that we're talking about here, they make all of this research available 100% for free. So you can just go to GiveWell.org and you can access all this research. No sign-up is required. They don't ask for any of your personal information. There's no tit for tat here. If you do use GiveWell to donate to these charities, 100% of your tax-deductible donation will go to those charities. GiveWell doesn't take a cut of your money at all. One of the reasons that I love using GiveWell to donate is that I can just give them money directly, and they will use their fancy models to allocate my dollars wherever they see fit to maximize that donation. But you don't have to do that. You can go and you can select any of the charities or funds that you like from their list of charities. So if you're thinking of making a charitable donation, Why don't you go to GiveWell, check it out, and give it a try? And if you go now and you haven't used GiveWell to donate to these charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $500 before the end of the year, or as long as matching funds last. To claim that match, to claim the up to $500 that GiveWell is willing to match to your donation, just go to givewell.org, pick podcast, and enter psych at checkout. So once again, go to givewell.org, and at checkout, select podcast, and write in psych if you'd like to let them know that you heard about them from us. Our thanks to GiveWell for sponsoring this episode of Psych. Paul, you and I remember the early days in which we were trying to get computers to learn how to talk. And understanding how human language works, that is, that we have words stored in memory combined with a set of rules that can generate sentences, it seemed like the natural way to go to try to get machines to be able to produce and understand human language. That turned out not to be the case, right?
Yeah.
Machines are incredible now. You and I could sit here and have an Android phone and turn on Google Translate, and it would interpret somebody speaking French into English almost instantaneously. But this problem was solved very different than a baby solves that problem.
Yeah.
What's the difference between the way that Alexa or Siri is processing language and the way that my 2-year-old might be?
In a sense, you're asking the easier question first, which is they're processing language largely through a series of rote memorizations. I ask Alexa, what's the meaning of life? Alexa, stop.
We're keeping that.
We're keeping that. Okay. I ask her, what's the meaning of life? She has a rote response. I ask her if she loves me. I ask her how old Vin Diesel is. She extracts enough of the meaning to do it, but she doesn't have
the big questions.
Those are the three big questions of life. And I got to say, the first two remain the same, but the third changes.
Right. So
I honestly use Alexa largely to figure out the age of celebrities and whether or not they're older or younger than me. And so it uses typically a very large set of rote forms, plus some rudimentary syntactic understanding. And it's nothing like a child. There's no generativity of language. There's no capacity for an unlimited number of utterances, except in a very boring sense. I could probably repeat things with different numbers in response to arithmetical questions. But now you get to a funny thing. And this is a real challenge to people like me who are very sympathetic to a Chomskyan idea, the idea I've been pushing. I often identify with the linguist Noam Chomsky. That language involves a hardwired, intricate, deeply intricate set of rules. But now we have these systems like GPT, which can produce very long series of utterances, not spoken, but written, in response to prompts that sound very human. On your podcast, Very Bad Wizards, you and Tamler Summers discussed a case where they took real-life utterances from the philosopher Dan Dennett, an esteemed philosopher of mine, then took a machine, put tons and tons of his utterances in there, and had the machine answer questions. And the task for people was, did Dan Dennett give this answer, or did this machine give this answer? And the results were kind of messy, but often it wasn't obvious which was which, meaning that we now have machines that can use language pretty darn well. But the machines don't do so through a Chomskyan grammar. Rather, they do so through massive statistical analyses of speech. And this raises a question. If the machines can do pretty well through massive statistical analyses, maybe that's what people are doing. And it seems to me that there are three possible answers to this. And I think in the next 10, 20, 30 years, we'll kind of know which one is right. One is that Chomsky was wrong. That you really can learn language just by chugging the statistics, figuring out what words go with each other. That's what the machines do. Kids could do the same thing. And that's how our minds work. And everything anybody would tell you about syntax is probably mistaken. The second possibility is that children learn rules just the way we're talking about. After all, there's so much evidence that they do. You know, you say to a kid, this is, you teach them a new word. This is a banana. This is one. This is a banana. I have one banana. He has many. And children will say bananas. They could do a rule. They create rules. So maybe the second possibility is that there's two ways to learn language. You could learn it through rules, and that's how kids do it. Or you can learn through massive statistical analysis, and that's how these machines do it. A third possibility, which I'm most sympathetic to, and it's defended by people like our colleague Gary Marcus, is that these machines are very, very impressive, but they very quickly fall apart. They very quickly produce utterances and make confusions that no human would make. And when you see this, this is because they lack a symbolic system. They lack generative rules of the sort that humans possess. And I think this is a very vibrant debate right now.
You mention in your chapter some work, at least providing some evidence that statistical learning is important and that it does play a role in the way that children learn languages. And that comes from work trying to figure out how children come to know in spoken language where one word ends and the other word begins. And I think anybody who's listened to a foreign language for long enough realizes that not only do you not understand the words, you often don't know when a word is starting and when a word is ending. It just could be one long word for all you know, right?
Yeah, that's a real puzzle. It does take a bit. If you only think about English and you only know English, you don't even see what the puzzle is. Of course, right. There's gaps between the words. People talk, and between each word, there's a gap. You can hear them. What's the problem? But then you listen to another language, and people are saying like "je ne sais pas." You're saying like, well, that must be one word because everything runs together. And you listen to a French speaker talk and it just goes on and there's no pauses. But of course, the trick is that once you know a language, the pauses are not in there in the words. And in fact, if you speak into an oscilloscope, you just get those lines bouncing around. There's no gaps corresponding. Words just gently flow into one another. And it's only when you hear a different language, as you put it here, manishma, in Hebrew, or je ne sais pas, in French, and they just blur together. You notice the problem. So how do kids solve the problem? How do they turn what's actually, when I'm talking now, just a stream of noise into separate words with sounds? Now, you could say, well, if they know what the words are, then they could segment them properly. But of course, if you can't find the words, how are you ever going to learn what they are? And so the solution developed by, in a really groundbreaking paper by Jenny Safran, Richard Aslan, and Alyssa Newport, paper, I think it was published in Science. And on a personal resonance, Jenny, who's a friend, published this wonderful paper at the same year she and I were going on a job market. So was I happy for her? Of course I was happy for her.
But were you happy, happy?
I was happy. That's a different question. And what they showed is that children are sensitive to transitional probabilities. And what that means is they're sensitive to how likely it is that one syllable will follow another. So imagine a kid hears a sentence like, oh, you're a good baby. Well, in that example, the you're and the they follow one another. You're a. The is followed by good, and the good is followed by baby. But the kid will also hear all sorts of sentences where good isn't followed by baby, where your isn't followed by a, and realize that these don't necessarily go together. But pretty much every time the kid hears bay, it's followed by b. And every time the kid hears mom, it's followed by me. And every time the kid hears me in that way, it might be followed by ma. And so the kid does statistics, and it's not 100%. But you start to figure out, well, if this word follows, if this is always followed by that, they must be a single word. And as I'm describing it, you know, you think, hey, you need an Excel sheet for that. That is really complicated. But they did these experiments where, let me actually just find this in the book. Kids would hear streams of sounds that go like, bida kap a doggy aula, bida bida kaktu baula, And the kids would hear this with no context. And then they'd figure out, well, whenever you say bih, it's always followed by something. But when you say ka, it's not always followed by something. And then they could use that to figure out language, to parse the sound stream into words. And that's sort of a study of phonological development, and it is so cool.
From the moment I first heard these studies, I thought that this was one of the coolest things I'd ever heard. And this adds some nuance to this debate, but it gets to the heart of a question that I wanted to ask you about, which was this idea that was put forward by Chomsky, where Chomsky said, well, look, here's how we know that language, at least large parts of what we mean by language, must be innate. Because kids just don't get enough information to ever develop full-blown language from what they hear. And he called this the poverty of the stimulus argument. And so the idea, which I always found compelling, was that if you want to tell a story that something is learned, you need to provide me with an answer to how the information from the environment can adequately explain what the child is producing. And Chomsky said, there's just not enough there. This work by Safran and colleagues was one of the first times where I thought, oh, I just couldn't see that it was there.
Yeah.
There is a lot that's there.
So you've perfectly summarized Chomsky's argument of the poverty of stimulus. There's not enough information in the world to account for what kids know. Therefore, what kids know must be innate. And you can make that argument outside of language. You might say, there's not enough information in the visual world to tell somebody it's a three-dimensional world, but boom, we see it as a three-dimensional world. Therefore, that must be innate. There's not enough information in the world to tell us that snakes are dangerous, yet kids from the get-go seem to think snakes are dangerous, therefore that must be innate, and so on. But as you pointed out, a lot of developments in a study of learning theory and analyses of kids' input have challenged Chomsky's view. I know a linguist, I think it was Dan Slobin, who called it the poverty of imagination argument, which is, you know, Chomsky's saying, well, I can't think of how it could be done, therefore it can't be done. And so the claim is that if you have a more sort of more sophisticated learning mechanisms, a deeper understanding of the information that kids receive, you can account for the learning of these rules, the acquiring of words, all of this without any sort of specialized structure for language, what Chomsky described as a language faculty or language organ. I'm skeptical. I think that there's been a lot of demonstrations of very early capacities in language that it's very hard to explain with through learning. But again, to go back through the sort of moral here that all of this is a matter of empirical debate and study, it's very open for somebody to create a computational model, feed in the into the computational model all of the language that children hear, and we actually have large databases that simulate the information that kids get through language. And then if you're right, the language model, if the words are English, the language model should come up with an English grammar. If they're Turkish, a Turkish grammar, and so on. If that was to be done, this would be pretty close to proof that this learning mechanism is what drives language. You don't need anything else. But the failure to find such a thing seems to suggest that we do have something more. In fact, and when people create models for learning language, and honestly, for just about anything else, the successful ones tend to build in a lot of hardwired knowledge.
Right. They sometimes slowly add rules until you realize that what they're demonstrating is not what they set out to demonstrate necessarily.
That's right. That's right. So a final question we can get to, because it's the question that everybody wants to get to, is the relationship between language and thought. So I just speak one language, English, you know, just barely. But you speak more than one.
I do. Yes. One of the most fascinating questions that I encountered as a young student in college was this question about how much language influences thought, perhaps because I had experience with two languages. And I knew, for instance, that there were cases in which one language provided me with a word that encapsulated a concept that I didn't have in another language. So I'll give you an example. in the Spanish that I know, there is a word that means to wear something for the very first time. That word is estrenar. And sometimes I would find myself wanting to communicate this by saying, I'm wearing these new shoes. And I found in English, this seems not only clunky to put this together, it's not as elegant as in Spanish, but also not something anybody would ever care to hear. It's sort of not, since it's not a word, it's also not a concept. So I might have been tempted taking that idea and pushing it. And when I first encountered what is sometimes referred to as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis or this linguistic relativism idea, I might have been tempted by this idea that certain languages either enable us to think things that we never would have thought or constrain us from thinking things. But as I learned, the question is a little bit more complicated and almost certainly not as sexy, as one might say, as might seem.
It's an idea which has had a very long history and lives on, I think, in classic literature. So one of my favorite books is George Orwell's 1984. And there, the dictatorship would have people speak in newspeak, which was a language of a very limited vocabulary. And the rationale for this is taking away people's ability to express certain thoughts, the thoughts themselves would go away. So if you don't have, and then often you say, then often you hear this in regular discourse say, well, these people, they don't have a word for courage.
Right.
Meaning that they don't think about courage. They are incapable of thinking about courage. So it's such a rich area. I think what's useful to do is let's talk about what's not a matter of debate. What's interesting, but nobody debates this. So one thing is, here's one claim. You can't have thought without language. Well, that's crazy. That's crazy wrong. Of course you can. I have all sorts of thoughts without language. If I'm trying to move a table down a hallway and trying to calculate how to balance the table and everything, I'm not using language. When I'm putting salt into a stew and tasting it and trying to figure out the right myself, I'm not doing this in language. And, babies don't have language and they can do some thinking. And dogs certainly don't have language. But to use an old example, a dog chases a skunk up a tree and is standing at the base of the tree and barking like crazy at the tree. It seems very reasonable to say the dog thinks the skunk is up the tree, but the dog can't say it. And finally, you get aphasia, you get brain damage that you lose your ability to use language. You even lose your ability to think in language, but you can still think. You just can't talk.
So unless by thought you simply mean putting thoughts into propositional language, then that doesn't seem to be right.
That's right. If you don't have language, then you can't think linguistic thoughts.
Right.
That's true. But you could certainly think. A second claim is that language influences thought. And people say, oh my gosh, that's what a claim. But that's incredibly obvious because language influence, when you talk to somebody, you hope to influence what they think. So I say, you better not vote for Schmidly. He'll ruin your life. Well, here I am throwing language at you, trying to get you to change your thoughts. You say to somebody like, I love you. Let's get married. I never want to see you again. You're throwing language at people and trying to change their thoughts. In fact, hopefully, people who are listening to us are going to hear all of our language being thrown at them, and simply as a real magic, their thoughts would change. And it's mediated through their own belief systems. I say something, and somebody listens and says, "That doesn't sound right to me. I don't agree," and that's possible too. But language does influence thought. Finally, and this is another obvious one, but it's actually very interesting. That the question is, does language reflect thought? And the answer is yes, of course, and in at least a couple of very interesting ways. One way is that universals of language probably reflect universals of thought. The prevalence of nouns, that they work like they do, probably reflects thought. The fact that for just about all languages, the prepositional system captures both spatial relationships and temporal relationships is really, really cool. So I could say, I'm in my house. But I could say, I'll do it for you in a week. I could say, the know, I will go to the park. The meeting will go to 9 p.m. And this is not a crazy quirk of English. Every language has an equivalent space and time. And that might tell us something startling about the human mind, which is space and time are treated as similar. And then you get to all of the sort of specifics. So the language, the words the language uses often reflect its priorities. The stuff about some people having 100 words for snow, a lot is really bogus. But the idea is not bogus. It makes sense that, you know, I bet if you're really into skiing, you probably have a lot of words for snow and snow conditions, and because you want to be able to talk about them. Sometimes you can figure out subtle things. So John McWhorter has a wonderful book on swearing, and he points out that you could learn from the language of obscenity what bothers people. So everywhere, obscene words have to do with sex and sex organs. Those are the sort of things that really, really get people bothered everywhere. But historically, it used to be words like, and you know, you and I are having this clean podcast discussion, but I will now say words like God and damn, which are, I think, even if we beep them out if I'm wrong, but I think are fairly, fairly uncontroversial. But they didn't used to be. And so a language like English created phrases like gosh darn or gee willikers, H-E double hockey sticks
right.
For hell. And if you said them now, you'd sound like Ned Flanders. But back then, they were ways to avoid saying terrible things.
You know, the wonderful TV show Deadwood employs a whole bunch of very, very foul language. And the creator, David Milch, apparently, even though he was a stickler for making sure that things were historically right, he didn't want sort of, you know, anachronistic things popping up in his show, stickler for details. This is one where he couldn't be a stickler for detail. And what he was trying to convey was that these cowboys in the Old West, or these gunslingers in the Old West, were very foul-mouthed. But the words that they used back then wouldn't have any sort of emotional impact on us now, because they have long since been considered very tame. And so he put a whole bunch of F words and C words and S words in there to convey the emotion rather than the specific words.
Yeah. You could tell, by looking at people's language, you could tell what they're interested in, what bothers them. And when it comes to obscenities, religious words have transformed. And that's a way of telling, just by looking at language, how we've changed our thinking about religion. Chomsky once talked about language being a mirror of the mind. And I think there you really see it. And to go back, by the way, to the point about thought without language, you actually presented a good example, which is, you know, in the Spanish you speak, there's a word for putting on something for the first time. I have no word for that in English. But it's not when you said that word, I said, wow.
What a novel thought.
I can't think that thought. You know, how does that work? How would it be like to think of such a thing? I said, okay, I get it. We just don't have a word for it. And if you ever wanted evidence that you could think of something where you don't have a word for it, those sort of simple examples do it.
This debate rears its head in an area that I study, and that is the psychology of emotions. Because one claim that you could make is, if you don't have a word for that emotion, maybe you don't experience it. And so there are a few examples that are often given. There's a word in Brazilian Portuguese, saudade, which is sort of being, it's a kind of nostalgia, it's a homesickness.
Yeah.
Schadenfreude, which is now an English word, has notoriously been associated with Germans. And the thought was, of course the Germans would have a word for taking pleasure in the misfortune of others.
there's a word in Yiddish, nachas, which is pride in the accomplishments of people close to you, typically your children.
And it can't be the case, right? It would be very difficult to communicate what I just communicated if you had no concept of what I'm saying. all you really have to do is say, oh, I can see being proud of my children or even my close friends, or miss being very homesick in that way. There's also famously work on this hypothesis of linguistic relativism and perception. And this is another clever way in which experimenters try to empirically test this, which is, let's take cultures that have a limited vocabulary for the color spectrum, at least compared to English. And so there are some cultures that lump together, for instance, green and blue. They only have one word for the part of the visible spectrum that comprises green and blue. Now, the strongest form of this claim would say, they can't even see. If you say, what color is the grass and what color is the sky, they're going to use the same word because they can't tell that they're two different colors, which I think is patently absurd. Now, are there influences of language that are subtle? Sure. If you give people those colors and you say, you give them a bunch of paint chips, swatches, and you say, lump together all the colors that are in the same category, they will put blue and green together in that category. And if you show them blue and green and red and yellow, and you give them a memory task and they're supposed to remember what colors they saw, they might be more likely to confuse the blue and the green, have a memory bias. But that they can't see those colors, I think, is, most people would agree, is absolutely wrong.
Right. So the strong version, the interesting claim by the Sapir-Whorf view from Benjamin Lee Whorf and Edward Sapir, is that the language you learn somehow shapes how you think about the world. And, you know, their case study was Navajo versus English, where they argued that Navajo has a very different time language and very minimal time language. So the Navajo don't really think about time the same way as somebody who learns to speak English comes to think about time. Now, this claim was turned out to be real nonsense. There's a wonderful book called Navajo Time, which talks about all the rich linguistic system Navajo has for time. But the idea might be right. And you can think of 100 examples. You can have examples of words, like the word you gave. Maybe by dint of learning Spanish, you tend to, when you see somebody putting on clothes for the first time, that tends to sort of stand out to you.
Attentionally. Yeah, an attentional effect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In English, you just say you, but in French, you say tu versus vous, marking a sort of status politeness distinction. Maybe a French speaker thinks more about status politeness. Right now, we often use he or she to refer to somebody. If in the future we shift and we only use they, maybe we think less about gender. I think these are all possible, and certainly for color terms, that the color, it would be really crazy, and I think people don't really say this, that somebody who only has four color terms can only make four distinctions in color. I probably only have four color terms, but I am horrible at color terms. Whenever I'm desperate, I say it's taupe, and because I understand taupe is a fancy color term, but I could tell them apart when you press them against each other. So then there's the research. And as you said, this research does have effects. But a lot of the effects are when you give people tasks involving involving the actual use of language. So memory tasks are a good example of this. I have an example in my book. You take a wine expert who speaks a rich wine language. So they sip and they sip some wine. They say, it's a Merlot with black raisin and floral notes. And I sip some wine and I say, it's red from a pretty bottle.
Right.
And now it's a day later and we have to remember it. The wine expert goes back to his or her story, Merlot with this, with that. And all I got is red. So if I encode it in language and she encodes it with language, I'm at a loss. Then there's a lot of studies looking at reaction time and whether or not, and looking at differences caused by language in a million subtle ways. And there's a lot of debate about this. And some people, some friends of mine say, oh, there is evidence. I know some other people says there's not a smidge of evidence, not even for the smallest effects. I think the safest compromise might be there may be some effect of language on how you think. But if so, it's extremely subtle. It's the sort you find in a laboratory experiment. And that could be really interesting from the standpoint of figuring out the architecture of the mind. But from the standpoint of saying, do you, as a Spanish speaker, see the world differently by dint of learning Spanish? For me, as an English speaker, that's probably no. And the differences we find are typically Spanish speakers are raised in different cultures than English speakers.
Right.
And that may have an effect. But the language, the structure of language, the grammar of the words probably don't.
You know, the sci-fi author Ted Chiang has a wonderful short story that became the basis for the movie Arrival, where he tried to push this Sapir-Whorf hypothesis to a sci-fi extreme. And the story goes that aliens come and visit and they have a completely different language that treats time completely differently. That is, it's not linear like it is for us in their language. It's more circular, where they can move between past, present, and future at will. And when that language is taught to humans, it unlocks this incredible ability in the protagonist to also experience time in a completely different way. To which I say, that is a great sci-fi story.
Great, great story. Big Ted Chiang.
Yeah. If it were the case that that were true, it would be amazing. But I think that it is not an exaggeration to say that language is a product of thought far more than thought is a product of language. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. I think language, plainly in all the ways we talked about, language can change people's minds and cause them to learn things. This is why we read books and listen to podcasts. But the sort of architecture of language, how it encodes time, the tense system, the aspect system, the nouns and the verbs, I think reflect systems of thought, and they don't create them. I would think that. The less interesting thing about the Ted Chiang story would be that the reason why these aliens had such a system is that they had a very different psychological conception of time, and their language reflected that. And if you don't have that reflection, that way to think about time, learning a language isn't going to help you at all. You know, learning, maybe this is a bit fanciful, but we have things, we'll call them languages, quote unquote, computer languages, like, you know, R or Prolog or Basic, Lisp, Fortran, whatever. Yeah. All my examples of computer languages are from the 70s.
When computers were the size of a room.
That's right. That's right. So you get all the punch cards all together. And many of us know how to code. And when we code, we use this quote unquote language. But this does not make us think like computers. It forces us to some extent to sort of understand how the language works and everything, but it doesn't reconfigure our brains in any massive sense.
At least not any more than just the thought is reconfiguring your brain.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I think that's a good place to end. Maybe I will end this particular chapter of our podcast, Paul, by answering one of the most fundamental questions in the world, and that is, 55 years old. That is how old Vin Diesel actually is.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Thank you.